This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for further cooperation among the Caspian littoral states as he addresses a summit of the regional countries to Turkmenistan. Moscow says the NATO summit confirms its policy of aggressive containment of Russia, calling the expansion of the Western military alliance a purely destabilizing factor. And another Palestinian killed by Israeli gunfire. Military forces shoot him in the chest during a raid in the town of Jenin. Thanks for joining us. The sixth summit of the Caspian Littoral States is underway in Turkmenistan's capital. Leaders of the five participating nations have addressed the event. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has said the Caspian Sea provides a context for expanding cooperation among the five bordering countries. He said that Iran seeks to make use of all potentials to boost cooperation. The Iranian President underscored the importance of unanimity in taking any decision about the Caspian Sea. Raisi rejected unilateralism in making decisions for the region. The Iranian President has already met with his Turkmen counterpart. When it comes to human rights, Iran has been on the receiving end of harsh, unfounded allegations of abuse made by Washington. One would ask how a violator of human rights could judge and accuse another country on the same topic, especially when that country, namely the U.S., has been involved in economic terrorism to the point that it has cost Iranian lives.
Iran is marking American Human Rights Review and Exposure Week, which runs from June the 27th till July the 3rd, which aims to highlight U.S. human rights violations towards the Iranian people. In a statement for this occasion, Iran's foreign ministry has released a report highlighting the U.S. violations of the rights of the Iranian people. One of the most blatant U.S. atrocities against the Iranian people is the economic terrorism the U.S. regime is committing through different sanctions.
I think what's interesting is that it should even come up that other countries have the right to bring the same charges against the United States that the United States has been using to sanction and punish and invade and occupy, to be honest, countries for the last 75 years. I think it makes sense for others to raise the issue of U.S. human rights violations.
Iran says U.S. unilateralism and imposition of unilateral economic sanctions with the aim of forcing governments to change their policies is a gross and systematic violation of human rights. It further highlights the fact that the imposition of unilaterally coercive sanctions by the United States has become a tool for violating the natural and legal rights of the Iranian people, including the right to life, the right to health, the right to adequate living standards, the right to education, and access to knowledge and technology. The Foreign Ministry report also touched on some of the repercussions of the sanctions, saying they had endangered food security, led to the non-cooperation of companies supplying medical and health goods and equipment with Iran, and disrupted purchase of drugs for rare and acute diseases. Sanctions on the aviation industry and aircraft parts have also seriously endangered the safety of Iranian passenger planes, while the lack of access to the international financial system and refusal of foreign companies to accept foreign exchange guarantees issued by Iranian banks have put additional economic pressure on bread earning.
The loophole, or what the United States has seen as a loophole, was that because it involves economics, it's not actually war. And this is complete crap. You know, I mean, and this is medieval war. Not only is it warfare, but it's medieval siege warfare by other means. It killed 500,000 children in Iraq. It's killing people in Iran.
Iranian women, and led to a decline in purchasing power of the elderly and problems for people with physical and mental disabilities in accessing medicines and medical equipment, adequate care and rehabilitation.
Iran says the United States is involved in economic terrorism since it has prevented the Islamic Republic from generating revenues, including by disrupting Iran's oil exports. But more importantly, the White House has made it impossible to import medicine and medical equipment, which has either jeopardized Iranian lives or to have resulted in the death of Iranians. The main motive for Washington's behavior in this regard, which has been labeled a war crime, is for there to be a change of government in Iran.
The U.S. animosity towards the Iranian people dates back to the 1950s. In 1953, the U.S., along with the U.K., plotted a coup against then-Prime Minister Mossadegh and toppled his government.
And if we go to the Iranian case, well, it just adds further hypocrisy to the notion of what the United States is doing about human rights violations around the world.
The U.S. helped reinstate a brutal dictatorial monarchy that suppressed their aspirations for a free and independent country. Right after the Islamic Revolution, the U.S. used various means to topple the Islamic Republic. It sided with the regime of Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran. The U.S. shot down an Iranian civilian airplane in 1988 and killed 290 people. The U.S. has supported various terrorist outfits to destabilize Iran. It has delisted the notorious MKO cult from its terror list. The group, which has committed various crimes against Iranian people, enjoys the support of U.S. officials. In 2001, the U.S. regime labeled Iran as part of the so-called Axis of Evil and sought to militarily confront Iran. The U.S. campaign of terror and threats against Iran culminated in former President Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign. But the policy was an utter failure. Now, after over four decades of animosity and plots against Iran and his people, the U.S. needs to change its stance towards the Islamic Republic.
Moscow says the NATO summit in Madrid confirms the military alliance's policy of aggressive containment of Russia. Russia's deputy foreign minister was speaking in response to NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, who said that NATO members will refer to Russia as a, quote, direct threat to their security in a new strategic blueprint sent to be unveiled during the summit later today. Sergei Ryabkov said the designation has nothing to do with real life. He said, quote, it is the alliance that poses a threat to us. The summit will also see NATO leaders inviting Finland and Sweden to join the alliance after Turkey dropped objections to the move. Ryabkov has censored it as a destabilizing action. Ukraine's President Zelensky has called for more aid from Western countries to help his country's fight against Russia.
Ukraine needs modern missile and air defense systems, and you have these systems. By providing them to us, you can completely break Russia's tactics of destroying cities and terrorizing the civilian population of Ukraine.
Zelensky said Russia must be isolated by more sanctions. The Ukrainian president made the remarks during a NATO summit in Madrid. On Monday, Washington announced that it would send sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine. It would be the latest in a series of Western arms shipments to the country. It also pushes the total U.S. aid to Kiev to over $6 billion since February. Moscow blames the West for prolonging the conflict by sending more weapons. Russia has repeatedly warned military aid to Ukraine would only worsen the circumstances and destabilize the region. Meanwhile, fighting rages on in eastern Ukraine, where the Russian military is pressing ahead with its operation to take the Donbas region. During the weekend, Russia took control of the commercial hub of Severodonetsk, and now it is pushing to seize its twin city, Lysychansk, where the governor says the situation is very difficult. Correspondent Johnny Miller in Donetsk has the latest.
The Russian army at the moment, they say they've taken about a third of Lysychansk. It is, of course, the twin city of Severodonetsk. That battle went on for a couple of weeks there. It looks like this battle for Lysychansk won't take as long. It looks like the Russians inevitably will take it. Much of the Ukrainian army has withdrawn, but they are putting up still a fierce resistance in that city. But it looks like only a matter of time until the Russians do take it. Then what will happen? It looks like the Ukrainians, they're determined to fight for every inch of Donbass. So it looks like they'll retreat to more defensive lines. Of course, the cities is where Ukrainians have most success defending against the Russians in open ground, even in trenches now. With the overwhelming Russian artillery and air superiority, the Ukrainians don't stand much of a chance. So it's in the cities they stand, they're able to put up a better defense. So there's the towns of Kramatorsk and Slaviansk. They may well retreat to those towns after Lysychansk, but it looks like it is only a matter of time until the Russians take that city.
Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian man during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Maher Marai died in the hospital after being shot in the chest by the regime's troops. Another Palestinian was injured during the confrontation. Israeli forces have also detained a total of 20 Palestinians as they stormed different neighborhoods across Jenin and Silwat since early morning. Jenin has been a focal point of Israeli attacks in recent months. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in and around the refugee camp since the beginning of the year. Our correspondent Mona Kandil tells us why the Israeli forces attack the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on an almost daily basis.
As you have mentioned, Mohammed Marai is not the first Palestinian who was killed by the Israeli forces in Jenin. The Israeli military, and according to experts, of course, that in recent months when Palestinians carried out anti-Israel operations, many of them originally came from Jenin area. That's why the Israelis are trying to show the Israeli street, the Israelis and the settlers themselves as well, that the military is not silent, that the Israeli military continue to chase Palestinian, they call terrorists, and raid Jenin area almost on a daily basis.
Elbit Systems, an Israeli weapons manufacturer, is being drummed out of the UK. It has already been forced to close down its headquarters in London, and activists are not stopping there. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in this report.
Potential choice for the UK competition, which
Elbit Systems markets its weaponry as battle-tested, and this is what it means. The Gaza Strip has become a showroom for Israel's deadly arms trade. While the death toll is counted, Israel uses footage to advertise its products, signing multi-million dollar contracts as a result. One of its customers is Britain, which also hosts Elbit factories. Palestine Action has successfully closed down its headquarters in London and in Oldham, and is now going after UAV, which makes end for Elbit's military drones.
Nestled in the British countryside, a factory producing weapons to be used against the Palestinians in the Middle East. So are the locals aware of what's going on here? The activists protesting here today say yes, and they also say momentum is building across the country in support of Palestine Action.
I think local community, until we started demonstrating here, were not aware what this company is doing. As a result of our protests, a lot more people are learning what this company is doing, and they are not actually supportive of it.
I came back from Bristol not long ago, and I had a Shut Elbit Down T-shirt on, and every child in the housing estate I was walking through started to chant it. They all knew who Elbit was. Now, when I was young, nobody knew really anything about the Palestinian they didn't really know what was happening.
The protesters also say that as Britons, they have a heightened responsibility to oppose the Israeli entity and fight for the liberation of Palestine.
We created this situation before even Britain had conquered that country. We gave it away to people who didn't live there.
One of the most interesting things, and I don't know if many people know this, the British Parliament in the 30s took a decision that there should be a representative assembly, as they did with their colonial, and that would have been a majority for the Palestinians. And the Labour Party, who are very, very strong supporters of Zionism, objected to that, and it was eventually defeated.
It was found out by, I think, CAT, a campaign against the arms trade, that 164 children died directly from drones made in the UK. And this factory makes drones, makes weaponized drones, which makes them ammunition, which means this is a weapons factory. There's often an argument, are they weapons, are they not? Yes, they are, they're weaponized, and they're classified as munitions. So, yeah, it's got to go.
The UK is said to be using Israeli weapons to stop refugees from reaching its shores. But in Britain, there is a colossal pushback against any cooperation with Tel Aviv. Millions of people regularly march in support of the Palestinian people calling for an end to apartheid and for Israel to be held accountable for its crimes against humanity. Bianca Rahimi, Shenstone.
Widespread starvation is looming on the horizon as the UN has slashed its funding for the war-ravaged Yemen. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says that over 19 million people are going hungry in Yemen. The figure is the highest since the start of the Saudi-led war on the impoverished country. According to the UN Children's Agency, about 2.3 million children are also suffering from acute malnutrition, as Yemenis are scrambling to get enough food due to 8 years of Saudi-led war and famine. Riyadh's military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The World Food Program currently provides food aid to 13 million Yemenis, but the agency has announced drastic cuts, meaning only 5 million of them will be able to access the assistance. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Congressman Mo Brooks was one of at least a half a dozen U.S. Republican congressmen who sought pardons immediately after the Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021. The head of White House presidential personnel, John McEntee, testified it came after Donald Trump hinted at a blanket pardon for the January 6th thing for anybody. We're prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled, U.S. Capitol Attack Hearings. If Republicans did nothing wrong, why were pardons sought? When the U.S. House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack revealed the evidence that showed Republican members of Congress sought preemptive presidential pardons after January 6, 2021, one of the most striking requests came from Congressman Mo Brooks. The request from Mo Brooks to the Trump White House came in an 11th of January 2021 email obtained by The Guardian that asked for all-purpose preemptive pardons for lawmakers involved in objecting to the certification of Joe Biden's election win. Mo Brooks, in the first instance, sought preemptive pardons for every Republican who signed the amicus brief in the Texas lawsuit that sued then-Vice President Mike Pence to unilaterally decide whether to certify Biden's win in certain battleground states. The Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks also recommended in the email to former Oval Operations Coordinator Molly Michael that Donald Trump's issue pardons for every congressman and senator who voted to reject the Electoral College vote submissions of Arizona and Pennsylvania. Mo Brooks was one of at least a half a dozen Republican congressmen who sought pardons immediately after the Capitol attack. The head of White House presidential personnel, John McEntee, testified it came after Donald Trump hinted at a blanket pardon for the January 6th thing for anybody. But the request from Mo Brooks stands out because he explicitly outlines two groups for whom he was seeking preemptive pardons, opening a window into his thinking and potentially revealing for what conduct he worried that they might have been guilty of a crime. The reference to the Texas lawsuit is revealing, since the lawsuit pushed Mike Pence to commandeer the ceremonial congressional certification to overturn the result of the 2020 election, which the Select Committee has argued amounted to a violation of federal law. Meanwhile, the reference to Arizona and Pennsylvania is notable, since the objections to those states occurred after the Capitol attack, which, seen with Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani asking senators to keep objecting to stop Biden's certification, could suggest further corrupt intent. Mo Brooks has rejected the notion that the pardon requests showed any consciousness of guilt, saying in a statement that he feared Democrats would prosecute and jail Republicans who acted pursuant to their constitutional or statutory duties under 3 U.S.C. 15. The statement referred to the statute governing the congressional certification of the presidential election, at which members of Congress are permitted to raise objections to the results in any of the states. But the trouble with Mo Brooks' statement remains that if he truly believed that Republicans were engaging in only lawful activity on 6th of January 2021, then he could defend that conduct in a court of law without the need for a presidential pardon. The House Select Committee at the hearing also showed testimony by Cassidy Hutchinson, a top former aide to Donald Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who said House Republicans Louie Gohmert, Scott Perry, Andy Biggs and Matt Gaetz also expressed interest in presidential pardons. Cassidy Hutchinson recalled that House Republican Jim Jordan did not directly ask for a pardon, but did ask whether Donald Trump was going to give them to members of Congress, and that House Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene expressed interest to the White House counsel's office. The testimony by Cassidy Hutchinson and John McEntee and other top White House aides showed that, at the very least, Republican members of Congress were concerned about potential legal exposure over their roles in Donald Trump's effort to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. And the accounts delivered under oath to the Select Committee showed the extraordinary and brazen inquiries by some of Trump's top allies on Capitol Hill to use the power of presidential pardons for their own political and personal ends. Select Committee member Pete Aguilar told CBS's Face the Nation program on Sunday, 26th of June, of the preemptive pardon requests. He said, "I think the American public understands folks asking for pardons generally feel they did something illegal." Louis Gohmert had brought the Texas lawsuit while Perry had played a role in Donald Trump's effort to pressure the Justice Department to reverse his election defeat in battleground states. Andy Biggs and Matt Gaetz had strategized with Donald Trump about objecting to Joe Biden's certification. The Republican members of Congress accused of seeking preemptive pardons near universally rejected the allegations. Louis Gohmert denied making a request for a pardon. Perry said in a statement that he never sought a presidential pardon for myself or other members of Congress. Andy Biggs said Cassidy Hutchinson was mistaken, and Marjorie Taylor Greene accurately called Hutchinson's testimony hearsay. January 6th Select Committee held its final hearing for this month on Thursday, 23rd of June, sharing new details about Donald Trump's efforts to pressure top Justice Department officials to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Across the committee's five hearings this month, investigators have presented a meticulous account of Donald Trump's exhaustive efforts to cling on to power after losing the election to Joe Biden. The panel has shown how Trump and his allies explored every possible avenue, from pressuring the Vice President Mike Pence to leaning on state election officials and Justice Department officials to promote lies about widespread election fraud. And Liz Cheney, the Republican vice chair of the House Select Committee, said the committee was only just getting started. Liz Cheney said on Thursday, 23rd of June, "At this point, our committee has just begun to show America the evidence that we have gathered. There is much more to come, both in our hearings and in our report." The committee had originally planned to hold only six hearings this month as investigators prepare to release their final report on the deadly Capitol attack this fall. But Benny Thompson, the Democratic chairman of the committee, said on Thursday that the hearings had sparked a flood of new tips about the insurrection, necessitating additional hearings next month. The committee is also now analysing footage from the British documentarian Alex Holder, who repeatedly interviewed Donald Trump and his family members in the days leading up to and immediately after 6th of January 2021. The committee issued a subpoena to Alex Holder for his video footage, and he met with investigators on Thursday morning. The common element of all of this was the president expressing his dissatisfaction that the Justice Department, in his view, had not done enough to investigate alleged election fraud. The British documentarian Alex Holder said in a statement shared on Twitter, "I have provided the committee with all requested materials, and I am fully cooperating with the investigation. I have no further comment at this time other than to say that our conversation today was thorough and I appreciated the opportunity to share more context about my project."
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
الجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali, based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently taking inspiration from the 16th sermon where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about his strategy. And the strategy was to fight against the gap that existed between the rich and the poor. The way people had forgotten the main principles of Islam and had gotten into worldliness and lavishness, and while others were suffering from poverty and destruction. This was a situation that the Muslim community had entered into also, and which Imam Ali alayhi salam was trying to combat. So now, this community, this Islamic community, who had gone through all those, beautiful moments in their growth, now decided to return back to their old days. Was it known in the very first instance that it has started to return and it started to regress in the wrong direction? Not straight away, but slowly with time, it was becoming clear that the community was, regressing, was becoming destroyed.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when was it clear? When did it become when did the reality dawn upon the Muslims that their community was now going in the wrong direction? It was when they saw that the big fighters and warriors of Islam, who are those big, heroes of Islam, they were now involved in earning wealth and just enjoying a lavish lifestyle and, becoming people who are now forming that lavish class and, creating that class of aristocracy. That is when people realized, that is when the people realized that, the situation has become bad. People started to see that people like Abdul Rahman bin Auf, on one hand. On the other hand, people like Zubair, people like Talha, people like Sa'ad bin Abi Waqqas, those big heroes, what had happened to them? They had started to create this class. They started to just earn. They started to make use of the society instead of give benefit to the society. They started to feel that now is their time to just enjoy and live a lavish lifestyle. And it was not only them, there were others also that started to have this type of idea about Islam. This is when the society realized that, oh, there's a whole difference now in the society. There's a whole class difference. There's a class of the rich and there's a class of the poor. We are saying it was sudden, but it was not sudden. It was a gradual process with a specific formula that led to this particular division that existed in the society at that time. This is a problem, a sickness that had started earlier, a seed that was sown earlier that slowly grew until it became now this big problem that the Muslim society was facing. And it had to happen because of the way it began. And now when the sickness became very apparent and it started to manifest itself, this is when the human values became nothing. Humanity was forgotten.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the Islamic society and what befell on it after the Prophet and how this whole sickness of division and this class of the poor and the rich that was formed after that, how it came to be. And we realized that after some time when this sickness had spread and started to manifest itself properly, then even the human values were forgotten. Values had now just become apparent things. Who is a human being? What are those qualities that you need to achieve as a human being? Those things were forgotten. In fact, a human being is that one who makes use properly of his opportunity, of his wealth, of his energy. But unfortunately now, that was not the case. Values had overturned. Values had become apparent things. Who is a true human being? A human being is someone like Abu Dharr Ghaffari. And when Abu Dharr was exiled, that was when the community realized that Islam had lost its value in the people's hearts. That humanity was no longer important. When in a society a person like Abu Dharr cannot live in security, whereby a person like a person like Abdullah bin Mas'ud, his ribs were broken by the people, by evil people. This shows that this community, this society has now become far from its true reality. When in a society, a Jew, an evil Jew, not all Jews are evil, but we are talking about an evil Jew here in this particular situation, an evil Jew comes and he becomes the chief of the scholars in a Muslim cabinet. When he becomes that, and then Muslim people come to learn under him, this is when you realize the human society, the Islamic society, is now deteriorating. This is when you realize that there is destruction happening. And Imam Ali alayhi salam was noticing all of these trends and he was trying to stop them. And let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that even in this day and age, we're able to stop these negative trends and try to create positive change in the communities. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., federal agents armed with a search warrant have seized the phone of John Eastman, a lawyer who advised former President Donald Trump on key elements of the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election, according to a court filing by Mr. Eastman on Monday, 27th of June. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Adam Goldman. The piece is titled Federal Agents Seize Phone of John Eastman, Key Figure in January 6 Plan. In the U.S., federal agents armed with a search warrant have seized the phone of John Eastman, a lawyer who advised former President Donald Trump on key elements of the effort to overturn the results of the 2020 election, according to a court filing by Mr. Eastman on Monday, 27th of June. The seizure of Mr. Eastman's phone is the latest evidence that the Justice Department is intensifying its sprawling criminal investigation into the various strands of Donald Trump's efforts to remain in power after he was defeated for re-election. In the past week alone, the Justice Department has delivered grand jury subpoenas to a variety of figures with roles in backing Donald Trump's effort, and it carried out at least one other search of a key figure. The court filing by Mr. Eastman, a motion to recover property from the government, said that FBI agents in New Mexico, acting on behalf of the Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General, stopped Mr. Eastman as he was leaving a restaurant last Wednesday and seized his iPhone. A copy of the warrant, included as an exhibit in John Eastman's filing, said that the phone would be taken to either the Justice Department or the Inspector General's forensic laboratory in Northern Virginia. According to the court filing, the seizure of John Eastman's phone came on the same day that federal agents raided the home and seized the electronic devices of Jeffrey Clark, a former Justice Department official who was central to Donald Trump's attempts to coerce the department's leaders into backing his false claims of fraud in the election. The Inspector General's office, which has jurisdiction over investigations of Justice Department employees, also issued the warrant in the search of Jeffrey Clark's home, a person familiar with the investigation confirmed. The warrant indicated that prosecutors are investigating Jeffrey Clark for charges that include conspiracy to obstruct the certification of the presidential election. A person familiar with the investigation has confirmed. Spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, which is overseeing the inquiry, declined to comment on John Eastman's court filing. With Mr. Eastman and Mr. Clark, the department is gathering information about two lawyers who were in close contact with Donald Trump in the critical weeks before the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob. The advice they were giving Donald Trump involves separate but apparently intersecting proposals to provide him with a means of averting his election defeat, with Jeffrey Clark focused on using the power of the Justice Department on Donald Trump's behalf, and John Eastman focused on disrupting the congressional certification of the election's outcome. The search warrant executed on John Eastman by the Inspector General's office may have been issued because of his connections to Jeffrey Clark, which were briefly touched on at a hearing by the House Select Committee on January 6 last week, a day after the raids on the two men. At the hearing, Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the panel's vice chairwoman, said that Ken Klokowski, a Justice Department lawyer who was in contact with John Eastman, also helped Jeffrey Clark draft a letter to Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, stating falsely that the Justice Department had identified significant concerns about the outcome of the election in Georgia and several other states. The letter further recommended that Georgia Governor Brian Kemp call a special session of the state legislature to create a separate slate of electors supporting Donald Trump. Ken Klokowski, who briefly served under Jeffrey Clark at the Justice Department and had earlier worked at the White House Budget Office, also worked with John Eastman, Liz Cheney said during the hearing. She went on to describe Mr. Eastman as one of the primary architects of President Trump's scheme to overturn the election. The Inspector General's office has the authority to look into any public corruption crimes committed by Justice Department personnel, said Michael Bromwich, a former Department Inspector General during the Clinton administration. Those investigations can lead to people and places outside of the Justice Department, Michael Bromwich said. He added, there must be a connection between John Eastman and someone who worked at the department. A former law professor in California, John Eastman helped develop and promote a brazen plan to justify having Vice President Mike Pence single-handedly block or delay certification of the Electoral College results showing Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory in the 2020 presidential election. In a series of meetings and phone calls, Donald Trump and John Eastman pressured Mike Pence to put the plan into action when Mike Pence presided over a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021. Mike Pence's refusal to go along with this plan helped fuel the violence that overwhelmed the Capitol on that day and became a bloody symbol of Donald Trump's effort to subvert the outcome of the election. Earlier this year, a federal judge in California considering a civil lawsuit concerning the release of Mr. Eastman's emails to the House Select Committee concluded that John Eastman and Donald Trump most likely committed two felonies: obstruction of a proceeding before Congress and a conspiracy to defraud the United States for their joint role in the pressure campaign against Mike Pence. John Eastman was also instrumental in advising Donald Trump to create purported slates of electors backing Mr. Trump in key swing states won by Joe Biden. These false pro-Trump electors were intended to give Mike Pence a quasi-legal rationale for delaying or blocking the Electoral College certification on 6th of January 2021, or even trying to throw the election to the House of Representatives. Last week, a federal grand jury in Washington issued subpoenas to several people who prosecutors believe may have information about the so-called fake electoral plan. Among those who received subpoenas were top Republicans in key swing states who served as purported pro-Trump electors, including Kelly Ward, the chairwoman of the Arizona Republican Party, and David Schaefer, the chairman of the Georgia Republican Party. The subpoenas, some of which have been obtained by the New York Times, show that prosecutors are seeking information about lawyers like John Eastman, who were close to Donald Trump during the chaotic post-election period. The subpoenas also seek information on other lawyers like Rudolph Giuliani, who oversaw Donald Trump's election challenges in general, and Kenneth Chesbrough, who wrote legal memos laying out the viability of the fake electoral plan. In John Eastman's court papers filed in federal district court in New Mexico, he says that the search warrant did not mention what underlying crime prosecutors were looking into by seizing his iPhone. On Monday night, 27th of June, John Eastman appeared on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show and discussed the seizure of his phone, repeating his complaint that the warrant never specified what violation of the law prosecutors were investigating. There was no indication of any crime this is connected to, John Eastman said.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful hadith and narration which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And this hadith is about foregoing alcohol and abandoning alcohol, shedding alcohol, which is one of the consumption of alcohol, you know, is one of the grave sins. God protect us all from it. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam alludes to why we should refrain from it. And this is interesting. The Prophet says that even if somebody forgoes alcohol, not for the sake of God, but for some other reason, let's say that, for example, he marries a woman. And that woman, she doesn't want her husband to drink alcohol. And he loves his wife, and, you know, out of respect for his wife, you know, he forgoes alcohol. Or let's say that, you know, let's say he was, you know,